So I do want to begin tonight with somewhat of a confession, and that is that despite the number of times I have read this final section of The Emergence of Ethical Man, I'm still not sure I know completely what he's saying. I have even with me two different sets of notes. And there are more like handwritten. I have at least written and rewritten about three times tonight, and I'm still not 100% sure I get all of it. I take solace in the fact that reading the little secondary literature that exists on this book also seems to conveniently ignore this section. I get the impression the first two sections where we spoke about the first week and last week are really the kind of the bulk of the really cool stuff people talk about. And then you get to here and you get the impression people are just like, not quite sure. Even the fact that they titled the book The Emergence of Ethical Man, and as I mentioned last week and we'll talk about today, we have left Ethical Man we left behind last week. We are no longer going to be talking about Ethical Man. Ethical Man, you know, died last week, and we're going to be looking at a new different type of personality. It seems that almost everyone agrees, and the reality is, as I mentioned before, these were books he didn't prepare to be published, and they were handwritten, and he didn't even finish it. So by the time you start getting to this back end of the book, there are still brilliant ideas, and we're going to talk about these tonight. But I am not 100%, I would like to think more, I have a good batting average for the past 2 weeks, as if you read the book and lined up with what I'd said, you'd be like, yeah, most of that was pretty good. This week, I will admit that there may be some things where it's like, you miss that bit. Or that bit seems a bit confusing compared to what he writes. I'm just going to throw that out there. There's still a lot of interesting things to point out. But particularly this past week when I asked my 11th graders at MIMO to summarize a different paragraph, not from this book of Rav Soloveitchik, and all but one of them completely botched it. One of them, which was brilliant, completely got what he was saying. The rest didn't have a clue. And that also prompted my own existential crisis in, am I doing the same thing with this? So just, you know, as we talk about it, there's still a lot of really cool things to explore. But there are a number of things that you read them and it's just like, I'm not quite sure what he's aiming for here. But with that caveat in mind, again, there's still a lot for us to gain. So let's begin. First of all, just by talking about last week and really the week before. So we're really, again, Rav Soloveitchik loves typologies. He loves describing kind of people and a kind of a type of personality that fits a certain set of rules through which we can better understand ourselves. And the first week was all about what we might call ontic man. And ontic man is simply, and we talked about this slightly at the beginning of last week also, ontic man is simply an upgraded animal. Not much more than that. What we spoke about last week is the one thing ontic man has is an awareness of his biological drives. We spoke about last week that before we even get to ethical man, the major difference between humans and animals is that we are aware of our drives. And we, in theory, can control them to some extent, but not completely because they are drives. We can't control our hunger drive completely because we'll die. But we can at least have restrained some of our drives. But ontic man, and the way Rav Soloveitchik reads this into the story of creation, is that while all creatures, including humans, are blessed via varech, humans are the only ones God turns to talk to. And Rav Soloveitchik argues that is God informing ourselves of our drives and our ability to control them. But that's ontic man. Ontic man can restrain his drives long enough to achieve a technical dominance of the world. So he doesn't use this example, but think of the example of you are hungry, but you know to plant something. And you know, if you wait long enough, what comes forth will actually be more beneficial. We have patience almost. That's ontic man. Ethical man is the next step, and that's really seen in the fact that what makes ethical man ethical is the vayetzav, the command. God commands man, and it's a somewhat arbitrary command, don't eat of this tree, and that's really the heart of the ethical command, is that man is not being asked to completely restrain all of his drives, it's merely just this one thing, you cannot do. You can eat of all the other trees, you can satiate your hunger drive, but this one tree cannot be eaten from. And at that point, man ceases to be ontic, starts to be ethical, and it's that same moment as Rav Soloveitchik reads into the story of creation in the second chapter of Sefer Bereishit, in the second chapter of Genesis. It's that moment also that God gives man a partner, creates woman, because at that point, humans are now distinct. Now humans are commanded beings. They are now distinct from all the other animals, and thus they can join together to form a community. And Rav Soloveitchik talks at length about sexual relationships being a vehicle for ethical union. He does talk about the fact that as humans, we can have ethical unions in many, many ways, but his focus is on the sexual relationship between Adam and Chava. But he then points out that very quickly, ethical man fails. Because ethical man is commanded not to eat from the tree of knowledge, and yet he does so. And as Rav Soloveitchik really brilliantly reads the Eitz Hadaat Tov V'Rav, which is typically translated as the tree of knowledge of good and bad, Rav Soloveitchik points out that Tov and Ra, good and bad, are also aesthetic words. So for instance, in the story of Yosef, in the story of Joseph, you have seven good cows, but that means like appealing cows. They are fat. They are attractive cows. And thus the whole Rav Soloveitchik reads the story almost entirely allegorically, as the pursuit of hedonistic pleasure. And the problem of ethical man is that he very quickly descends into hedonistic man. And I didn't say this on the tape last week, but I say hedonistic. I'm not mispronouncing it in England. That's how we pronounce it. I know you say hedonistic, but I'm not going to do it. Hedonistic, but going back now. The pursuit of hedonism. And what basically happens is, everything bad that happens in the Torah before Abraham is due to humanity's inability to control its hedonistic lust. The idea of Hamas, the violence that precedes the story of the flood, is that same idea of if you're violent, if you're stealing things, if you're murdering people, you can't control yourself. You're just giving in to whatever whim takes you. And this leads to source number one, which is how we're going to pick up and move into a new type of personality. Rav Soloveitchik writes, "The rift in the human personality we have seen unfold over the first three chapters of Genesis, the deviation from the united ideal of creation engendered by the primeval couple's pursuit of Edone, called for a unique type of person who would restore the unity of the ethical and the aesthetic." So again, the idea is that ethical man has become consumed by the aesthetic to the almost absence of the ethical. And these need to be once again unified. The process of the realization of the charismatic personality is described in the biographies of the three patriarchs and Moses. Let us begin by analyzing the figure of Abraham, the first Jew. And so what Rav Soloveitchik does in the final section of The Emergence of Ethical Man, as we have it, is take a look and analyze Abraham and Moshe, and what makes them emblematic of the charismatic personality, charismatic man. Abraham, really easy to understand what he's saying. It's when he starts getting to Moshe, and you're going to see this yourselves because I just gave the bullet-pointed conclusion that they have in the book. When we get to it, he does a lot of things with Moshe. That's where things get a bit confusing. But first, let's take a look at Abraham. And charismatic man has for Rav Soloveitchik a few different features, a few different key important characteristics. One is a rejection of authoritarianism. The second is this election, the choosing of God. The major difference between charismatic man and ethical man is while ethical man understands God as a moral commander, he nonetheless exists purely as subject. He is created by God, and he exists to serve God and obey God. For Rav Soloveitchik, charismatic man, in contrast, chooses God. He elects God. God is not just an overlord who has chosen him to serve, but also someone he has chosen to serve. And the third and really key aspect is a historical relationship with God. Just a general historical realization that man ceases to be purely rooted in kind of his natural drives and his physicality, and instead has a historical awareness. Those three things, and we're going to talk about all of them in more detail. And it begins with source number two. So we only read it now a couple of weeks ago. The opening, even though technically Abraham's story starts slightly before this, the true dramatic opening of the Abraham story. Vayomer Adonai el Avram, lech lecha me'artzecha u'mimoratcha mi'beit avicha el ha'aretz asher ara'eka. God turns to Abraham, go forth from your native land, from your father's house, to the land that I will show you. God commands Abraham, get out from where you are and move to the land of Israel. And Rav Soloveitchik puts tremendous significance in this move. And the first thing he actually does is he rejects the most popular idea for the move, and that is that there is something special to the land of Israel. This is most famously advocated by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in his philosophical work, or anti-philosophical work, the Kuzari, and Ramban Nachmanides, who all argue that the reason Abraham had to go to the land of Israel was because of its inherent holiness. Which Rav Soloveitchik has this great line where he's like, it smacks of the fetishism of objective kedusha. Rav Soloveitchik doesn't like this idea that something can be, that a piece of land can be inherently holy and that automatically makes it great. Rav Soloveitchik says, in this particular instance, the significance of God's command to Abraham is not the place he is going, but the fact that he has to leave. Abraham has to abandon everything in order to become the charismatic personality, in order to become a partner with God. He must leave everything behind. He attaches tremendous significance to the fact that Abraham living in Mesopotamia is living in really a major part of society. He's living in a highly, for its time, a highly advanced part of civilization, and he must leave that and head into basically the absolute middle of nowhere, into Canaan, which is this kind of, you know, ragtag group of, you know, confederate states all, you know, living in, you know, tension with one another. He has to leave. And the reason is for Rav Soloveitchik is because the charismatic personality must be lonely. And he has this wonderful phrase where the first prerequisite for prophecy is loneliness. A lonely man finds the lonely God. Can't help but wonder how much Rav Soloveitchik is being somewhat autobiographical here, as he himself always found himself lonely. So he gravitates to the loneliness of Abraham and Moshe here. But charismatic personality must be lonely, because God himself is lonely. And as Rav Soloveitchik also points out, God is also jealous. He's a jealous God. And Rav Soloveitchik kind of takes this further to the idea that, and really kind of stretching the metaphor as far as it can go, to be in a relationship with God, it's like being in a married relationship with another person. You can't have another interest. So for Abraham to be, you know, a true partner with God, there can't be anything else, you know, getting in his way. He must partner with God. He must be lonely. That Abraham has a whole entourage with him doesn't get in the way of Rav Soloveitchik's broad point that Abraham is leaving behind. He's abandoning everything he's come from in order to go out and meet God. And the other reason is because this rejection of authoritarianism, Rav Soloveitchik actually uses the term anarchist. The charismatic personality must be an anarchist, anarchist, if you're wondering what word I'm saying because of my accent. But the point is that for Rav Soloveitchik, there's two different types of anarchy. And the first kind is the good kind. It's the kind of Abraham, where a person senses that a number of their laws aren't rooted in any sense of morality. That is good anarchy. That is the anarchy of the charismatic personality, as opposed to the hedonistic personality, which seeks complete anarchy just because they don't want to be governed by anything. That's bad. So Rav Soloveitchik uses the term anarchy here in the sense that, again, it's rejecting the authoritarianism. That, again, the charismatic personality sees the corruption of the world around them and realizes at a certain point they just have to leave it. Again, ethical man kind of ended with descending into hedonistic man. And the charismatic personality begins by realizing they just can't live in that world anymore. They can't be surrounded by the hedonism and the lack of morality. And that's what, for Rav Soloveitchik drives God to demand Avraham leave. Avraham has to leave that place surrounded by all of these, you know, surrounded by all these problematic ideals. And that, for Rav Soloveitchik, is the key to this command here in verse number 2. It's all about getting Avraham out and away from everything else around him, plunging Avraham into a sense of loneliness so that he can communicate with God. What we also see with the introduction of Avraham is the notion of a covenant. And covenants are really interesting because, as Rav Soloveitchik points out, the whole idea of a covenant is there is a mutual relationship between the two parties. God is no longer purely mitzvah, commanding Avraham, but rather he's entering into a covenant. He's saying, you must do X, but in return, I will do Y. And thus, God is no longer purely a figure of authority, but he's a figure of partnership. He enters into a covenant, and Rav Soloveitchik argues, you see this most clearly in the story of the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, where God, for Rav Soloveitchik, never explicitly commands. It's much more, it's like, it's a suggestion. It's a conversation. He turns around to him. He doesn't command Avraham. Unlike ethical man, who it's like, Vayetzav, Hashem Elohim, God, the Lord God, commanded Adam, it's Vayomer. He speaks to him. He says, take your son, your only son. The point is that already here, there is this idea that God is conversing with Avraham. He's not purely commanding as a sole authority, but there is a sense of relationship. That doesn't change the fact that God makes certain demands, but it changes the nature of the person who is being demanded. And we also see, and we read it last week, forgetting which parasha it is, but when Abraham refers to God as Hashofet Kol Haaretz Lo Yaseh Mishpat, will the judge of the earth not do justice? That this also signals how Avraham views God. He recognizes God as not just the God of the cosmos, but as a moral figure. And so with Avraham, you really start to see a proper relationship between humans and God. God is no longer, for all other animals, God is, and this was for Rav Soloveitchik what drove the snake to down its path of doing what it did, was that God purely appears as just kind of a do this, don't do this, for no justifiable reason. For ethical man, God's commands can be comprehensible, but it's still very much a one-way relationship. It's just don't eat from the tree, just cause. With Avraham, we now start to see this relationship of covenant, this idea that he recognizes in God a moral force. He recognizes in God the idea that, you know, observing his will is not just something demanded of him, but it's something that's part of the covenant. And in return, Avraham will be a blessed person. And this brings on to maybe the most fascinating idea that emerges here, which is moving away from man rooted in his naturalness, in his, again, we're just animals, but what makes the charismatic personality really the charismatic personality is the historical awareness. And Rav Soloveitchik makes a really amazing point here. Take a look at source number 3. So it's from V'Adonai Amar El Avram Acharei Hipared Lot Me'imo. So this is the point where Lot has just left Avraham. Sana einecha or air, raise your eyes and look up, min hamakom asher atasham, from where you are, tzafona vanegma vakedma vayama, north, south, east, west, ki et kol haaretz asher ata ro'elecha etnena, everything you see I will give to you, ul zaracha ad olam, and to your offspring. Kum hit halech vaaretz li'arakar ulerachba, ki lecha etnena, walk about the land, its length and breadth, for I give it to you. Rav Soloveitchik makes a really, really fascinating point here. God promises that he will give the land to Avraham. But Avraham doesn't become the owner of the land. Avraham dies, at best, as we will read this morning, owning a tiny plot of land. Like, he buys, for a lot of significance is attached to the buying of the cave of Machpelah, because that's like his actual first purchase, but that's all he purchases. You know, by the end of Sefer Bereshit, his children aren't even in the land of Israel, they're in the land of Egypt. By the end of the Torah, and Lord Sachs himself takes us in a slight, very different direction, but by the end of the Torah, they're still not in the land of Israel, and by the end of Tanakh, as a whole, the Bible ends itself with them no longer in the land of Israel. This idea, admittedly, at a certain point, the land does become theirs, but Abraham himself never actually receives that promise of God. Neither does Yitzchak, neither does Yaakov. The land is not conquered until after the Torah and, you know, the book of Yehoshua, the book of Joshua. For Rav Soloveitchik, what this points to is what he describes as a quasi-mystical communion between him and his descendants. That Abraham may not take possession himself, but the fact that his descendants do fulfills the promise of God. That even though God says, Abraham, you yourself, ki lecha etenena, I'm giving it to you, but he doesn't actually give it. Abraham himself doesn't actually take possession of the land. His descendants do, and this is really the major aspect of charismatic man, this idea of realizing that we do things not just for ourselves, but we have a much longer span. We have a much longer way we look forward. We don't just do things. In contrast to the hedonistic person who does things right for the here and now, the charismatic personality, in contrast, doesn't just do things for their own future, but in fact does things for a future they may never see themselves. Then thus, what happens is really this sense that fulfillment happens in the future. And Rav Soloveitchik also attaches tremendous significance to the fact that the Jewish people are referred to as Yisrael, which is also one of the names of Yaakov. And for Rav Soloveitchik, in a sense, we are him. That it's not just we are known by his name, but we are him. We are the embodiment, the continued embodiment of Yaakov as Yisrael. And so what we are doing now is really something being done by Yaakov and being done by his father Yitzchak and being done by his father Abraham. And as he writes in source number 4, the natural ego is assimilated into an individualistic ego who lived at the dawn of history. The nation is unique and as lonely as their father shepherd Abraham was. The people relive his life. Of course, in a different environment, yet in identical situations. The uniqueness of such a historical existence consists in projecting a present onto a mystical future, and vice versa in tying it in with a dim past. What Rav Soloveitchik doesn't make note of here, but he makes note in other places. So Ramban and Nachmanides set a lot of store by the concept of Ma'aseh Avot Siman Labanim, that the actions of the fathers affect their future children. Ramban reads the entire stories of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov as predicting the future. So it actually lines up really nicely that, for instance, Abraham's travel down to Egypt and leaving is the way it's described is also a perfect succinct summary of the experience of slavery in Egypt. So Ramban really, really, and how one squares this with ideas of free will, we're not going to open that Pandora's box. But for Ramban, Ma'aseh Avot Siman Labanim, everything the forefathers did will happen to their children. Again, I mentioned this past Shabbat, Ramban is, of all the figures, the most willing to criticize the actions of the Avot. And so he points out that Sarah's mistreatment of Hagar the Egyptian leads later to the Egyptian mistreatment of Sarah's descendants. So for Ramban, a lot of attachment is played there. Rav Soloveitchik in other places doesn't necessarily go as far as Ramban, but he clearly likes this idea. He clearly, and here it's almost, it's the reverse of Ma'aseh Avot Siman Labanim. Ma'aseh Avot Siman Labanim is what Abraham did, we will do. And here Rav Soloveitchik reverses it, what we do, we are really doing as Abraham. That Abraham, our ownership of the land of Israel is a fulfillment of his, because we are his descendants, and as a historical, with that historical awareness, it means that, you know, I myself might not achieve X, but if later generations in the family achieve X, it is as though I did it. That for Rav Soloveitchik is the historical awareness. And this is why God puts so much emphasis, first of all, in being the God of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but with the implication that at the same time he is our God. When he appears to Moshe, he points out that he is the God of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and at the same time emphasizes the continuation of that into the present. God describes himself when Moshe asks, you know, God for his name, he tells him his name is like Ehayah Asher Ehayah, like I will be what I will be. It's really a horrible phrase to translate. But for Rav Soloveitchik, this emphasizes God is kind of, he's not just the God of the forefathers, but he is the God continuing through to this time and expecting Moshe and the Jewish people to continue on that mission. That our own actions are the same actions of those people who've come before us. And that leads Rav Soloveitchik to make a really, 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 really interesting point. I don't think, I was trying to see if I could, how far one could claim this. You could read the next two sources as saying something really, really radical. I don't think Rav Soloveitchik is saying something as radical as what we're about to read, but I think he's nonetheless not uncomfortable with the idea. I'll explain more after we've read. So take a look at source number 5. And it's from the Gemara in Sanhedrin, and it begins, Minayin etchiyat hametim min haTorah. How do we know that the Torah itself preaches the resurrection of the dead? Shne ema, as it says in the Torah, Untantem minmenu et trumat Hashem la'aharon hakohen. And you shall give, we are commanded to give the truma, the tithe, to Aharon, the Kohen. V'chi Aharon le'olam kayem. But Aharon isn't always living. V'halo lo nichnas le'eretz Yisrael, shenot in lo truma. And Aharon never entered, he died before they entered the land of Israel, and truma is to be given in the land of Israel. Ela melameid she'atid l'chayot. Rather, Aharon is destined to once again live in the future. V'Yisrael notnin lo truma. And the Jewish people will then be able to fulfill the command, give Aharon the truma, the tithe. Mikan l'tchiyat hametim min haTorah. From here we learn that the resurrection of the dead is from the Torah. And a similar thing happens a bit later on with Abraham. Similar argument. And this leads Rav Soloveitchik to say the following. Our rabbis singled out the unique biblical usage of the name of the founder, Aharon or Abraham, for the identification of the group, and concluded from that the founder is immortal. The argument is comprehensible only when we consider it from the viewpoint of historical perpetuation. The land was promised to Abraham, Teruma to Aharon. The realization of this promise did not occur in their lifetimes, but many years later, and yet the word of God came true. Why? Because the founder continues his existence throughout the history of his group. Whatever is realized in the course of the historical occurrence is to be understood as a personal attainment of the founder. What Rav Soloveitchik is saying here is, how can we still give truma to Aharon? Well, because Aharon lives in every single Kohen. How can, if Abraham received the land of Israel, how can it be? Well, we all receive the land of Israel. The radical point I don't think he's making, because I think he's making a poetic point rather than necessarily a philosophical point, is, but then if this is how resurrection of the dead works, then you don't need Aharon to come back to life, because if his descendants are the embodiment of him, which is why I don't think this is kind of, we've unearthed some kind of shocking viewpoint of Rav Soloveitchik about the actualities of resurrection of the dead. I'm sure you could try and take it in that direction, but I don't think it would stand much ground pretty quickly. I get the impression Rav Soloveitchik wasn't sometimes bothered by saying things to make a point that could yield wider, more complicated conclusions. He didn't care about his words being taken out of context, he just wanted to make a point here. But the point here is really, really powerful. For Rav Soloveitchik, in a sense, what is the resurrection of the dead? That the figures, people physically may die, but they live on in their descendants. That people continue to perpetuate the values of those who came before them. That they continue to do the things. So every single priest becomes, when they receive their truma in Israel, they are continuing the path of Aharon. And so it is as though Aharon himself is receiving truma. And this Vorav Soloveitchik is what really creates the charismatic personality. It's this historical awareness, because, and he doesn't make this point, but I will. I think in a sense, the historical awareness, and I kind of already said this a few minutes ago, like cures the hedonism, because the ability to do things for a long time, before even Ontic Man was able to restrain his drives for technical knowledge, he was able to hold off on fulfilling certain biological drives in order to achieve something. Ethical Man really struggles with balancing the pleasure he gains from the drive with the command. The almost the solution to it is, it's almost like, you know, classic, you know, doing your work 101, like, do it now so you don't regret it in the future. Like, push off the immediate, you know, pleasurable results of not going into work today so that you're not frustrated with tons of work later on. That's really what the historical awareness does on a much larger scale, is it pushes off the temptation of hedonism, in a sense, to know that there is something out there in the future that we are working towards, that we are building towards. And so the charismatic personality is constantly aware of his connection to historical continuity. And this then leads Rav Soloveitchik to start discussing Moshe, and everything spiral out of control. But first, the Moshe bit. So the key thing for Rav Soloveitchik is there's a few different phases in charismatic personality, because the promise hasn't been fulfilled. That's kind of the whole point here. So for Avraham, it's almost, there is a lot we can learn, but he just gets all the promises, but he doesn't have the struggle of finding out if they'll ever be fulfilled, because once he knows they'll be fulfilled in the future, if he accepts that, but Avraham never has to encounter the struggle and difficulty of waiting for those promises to be fulfilled. So he's the free charismatic personality. He can discover God very easily, Avraham, because it's almost all glory. It's almost all like a wonderful life. And in contrast, when you shift to Moshe for Rav Soloveitchik, Moshe is not only the person who fulfills that promise, but also very much a child of that struggle. Slavery in Egypt is that struggle to have that promise fulfilled. All the trials and tribulations before getting to the land of Israel, that is, you know, the difficulty, the gap between the promise being made and the promise being fulfilled. It comes with, for Rav Soloveitchik, this very challenging period. But Rav Soloveitchik does begin with noting that there are actually many, many similarities between Moshe and Avraham. They both grow up in kind of the center of civilization. It's kind of a technological society ruled by tyranny, Mesopotamia and Egypt. Both of them have that. Both flee, though for very different reasons, because Avraham flees because God commands him, Moshe flees because they're going to kill him. They both, for Rav Soloveitchik, revolt against human notions of morality, and they both encounter God in their fleeing. So for Avraham, he's very into kind of, you know, right things being done. For Moshe, he's outraged at the mistreatment of the people. But the major difference for Rav Soloveitchik between Avraham and Moshe is, while Avraham abandons all, Moshe returns. And Moshe, there is a good question that he doesn't engage with, which is, at which point does Moshe actually abandon his Egyptian identity? We know for certain when he first flees Egypt, he's still very visibly Egyptian. As Rav Soloveitchik points out, he's described as an Egyptian man by the daughters of Yitro. They say an Egyptian man rescued us. So clearly he looks very Egyptian. There are other commentators, Rav Soloveitchik doesn't discuss this bit, but there are other commentators who point out one of the whole points and purposes of Moshe is that, having grown up in the royal palace, he's comfortable in that environment and he knows what he's doing. So you can even imagine he's still very, very Egyptian when he's in the palace, because he's playing the role he needs to play. But the point is, in a sense, Moshe always, unlike Avraham who fled, Moshe rejoins society. But what for Moshe is so key is that he also becomes the emissary of God. For Moshe, unlike Avraham is a partner of God, But for Moshe, that relationship becomes almost, it becomes far, far, the connection between Moshe and God becomes far stronger. Rav Soloveitchik notes the verse in Sefer Bamidbar, which says the Jews were saved by an angel. And he says that Moshe is so connected, he's angelic almost. He is almost a pure emissary of God. That the, as he points out, and here's, what they turned into a footnote in the book. And again, there is a lot of Rav Soloveitchik wanting to clearly distinguish Judaism from Christianity. Rav Soloveitchik's point is that the difference between Moshe and Jesus is that Christians, in his words, not his exact words, paraphrasing, they couldn't really square this idea of being God's emissary and also being human, so they made him divine, whereas Judaism is still, Moshe is still very much a human. He's the charismatic personality. But what he really does is he takes the Jewish people through these various stages. And the culmination of these stages is the giving of the Torah. And it's at that point that the Jewish people do a couple of really, really key things. The first is it's the election of God. And if you think about it, again, they join a covenant. So once again, they re-enter this partnership in which they acknowledge God as their king. There is almost this sense of that opt-out makes the opt-in that much more powerful. The fact that they choose to have God be their God makes that choice. It's not just he picks them, it's they chose God to be their God. And indeed, when you think of on Rosh Hashanah, the fact that every single year we coronate God, we are almost re-accepting that covenant upon ourselves. We are almost, once again, we are being like, God as king, and I guess this is a powerful idea for kings in general, the idea that the people choose a king who will then rule over them, but nonetheless that election of the king is a powerful statement. But what really Rav Soloveitchik then attaches tremendous significance to is one of the purposes of mitzvot in general in the Torah, which is imitatio Dei, imitating the divine. That the true culmination of the charismatic personality and thus the true, and again, the book ends, you know, clearly not at the end. So I don't want to say the true culmination, because who knows, he may have had a further culmination in mind. But the true culmination as we know it is that man seeks to imitate God. We do the mitzvot because in some way or another, that makes us more like God. And so you go from the human being. Again, we mentioned the first week where Rav Soloveitchik is trying to find that dividing line between Ontik man and the Tzelem Elokim, that divine spark. What are we in the image of God? Through our actions. And that's really what I think is almost the powerful ending of the work, is that we start life as nothing more than animals. We have a bit of an awareness of how we work. We understand it, but that's it. The project of ethical man doesn't really work. And purely being commanded to not give in to certain drives create certain important aspects of community and the ethical union, the I-Thou relationship, which we talked about last week, but it fundamentally can all too easily slip into hedonism. What ultimately ends up happening is the free election of God and the entering into a partnership with God in which man, humans, through observing the mitzvot, cease to tie themselves as much to their physicality while still being human, but instead are actually able to bridge that gap by trying to act more like God. And the way we free ourselves, as it were, from our inherent animal aspects is by doing things in the service of God in order to imitate him. It's that almost reaching out to the divine that really illustrates the Tzelem Elokim, the divine image within us, as we try to imitate him, as we follow in his ways. That is when we start to resemble that glorious depiction of humanity Rav Soloveitchik began with and kind of disagreed with, but it's only through the efforts of imitatio Dei that happens. And what I want to turn to now is the way Rav Soloveitchik, or at least the editors, took Rav Soloveitchik and then summed him up. And this is a really good way of just giving a high-level overview of basically everything, because
as you'll see there are 9 points. Even though we've really only been dealing with 3, maybe 4 types of people, there are actually 9. But let's begin. And as you can see, I just literally photocopied this from the book because I was not going to type that out. Okay. You, by the way, one thing I've learned when you type things out from books, what looks like a small paragraph is surprisingly long. So I didn't even bother attempting this, but I'm just saying, I look at like point one and you think, oh, that must take like 2 minutes to type out. You don't realize how many words are in a typeset paragraph until you try to type them out. But his conclusion, the conclusion of the book, now let us review the different phases through which the emergent human personality passes. Number one, man as a biological being against his genetic background, animal in all its insistences and demands. The only difference between man and animal is the extent to which the technical intelligence has progressed. Man as described in the first chapter of creation and in our first share of this series. Number two, man acquiring personality by experiencing the ethical norm and getting involved in sympathetic coexistence with the Tao. Man begins to separate from the natural realm and encounters in his subjective capacity an objective world. Ethical solidarity is characteristic of this stage. Man is described in the second chapter of Genesis and last week in our second shiur. Also three, also, and by the way, if you can already tell, 2 shiurims worth of these classes was points 1, 2, 3, and then 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 was today, and you wonder why it's confusing, because apparently he said all of these points. But first three, man splitting his existence into an ethico-natural and orgiastic demonic personality, introducing horror into the world and attempting to deceive his genuine ego, the original sin. That was also last week. That is the descent into the hedonistic. Which brings us to four, the free, charismatic, anarchic, and lonely personality, which revolts against man-made institutions and mores and discovers the moral law, chances later upon the god of morality and becomes acquainted with him. That's Abraham. Five, the historical personality, which immortalizes itself through covenant historical reality by continuous self-revealing in the covenant society. At this stage, man raises concrete naturalness to historicity. That's point five, and probably the point at which I feel like I'm not sure where we're going, which is why 6, 7, 8, and 9 are so helpful. Six, the antithetic charismatic personality of the interim period, who is captivated and captured by the numinous god, Moshe at the burning bush. That's the gap between promise made and promise fulfilled. Seven, the imprisoned charismatic personality. The imprisoned charismatic personality, freeing itself from numinous horror by retracing the footsteps of historical development or by identifying itself with the charismatic founder. The interim chosen personality reconstructs freedom out of historical necessity. By the way, if the parentheses were made by the editors, even they don't get what he's saying here. And if those parentheses where Rav Soloveitchik labels things were made by himself, even he didn't know what he wrote. But anyway, eight, the apostolic personality, tied in by a bond of solidarity and sympathy with the God of the covenant. The apostolic personality is the redeemer who co-participates in the drama of realization. In other words, the man of the miracle appears, the harmonious personality that reconciles the natural with the historical order, Moshe through the plagues and the exodus from Egypt. And nine, the theopolitical personality, which asserts itself in a state society that is dedicated to a single objective, to live in comradeship with God and to freely abide by his will. It should freely abide by his will. There is not only a covenant between God and man, but a socio-political bond as well. The religious ethos assumes a legal aspect. The subjective ethos becomes an objective moral law. Moshe at the revelation at Sinai. So the culmination is a society led by charismatic man, Moshe, that ends up dedicating itself to the pursuit of God, but through a free and fair election. They choose to have God as their God, enter a covenant with him, and through that, and through observing his laws and his commands,
are able to truly, you know, become, not become him, but at least bring out that Tzelem Elohim within, unearth that godliness within. So within nine stages, we go from man as animal to man who can imitate God. And all these various phases, 1 through 9, highlight a different aspect through which humanity is formed and turned into eventually what the Torah desires for Rav Soloveitchik. It's almost, and especially with Moshe, and I guess it makes sense that Moshe does so many things because Moshe has 4 books of the Torah. But the point is that Moshe kind of goes through so many of these stages himself. But the Torah ends with the fulfillment of that promise, but that comes on the part of also the Jewish people keeping the covenant.